Today's Tay Show will be on case 42 in the Momonkon, in the Gate of No Barrier. Case 42 is entitled, The Girl Comes Out of Samadhi. Once in the old days, in the time of the World Honored One, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers once, took her up to the Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. The World Honored One said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up." But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to rouse her from samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the World Honored One, who gave him his imperial order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mulan's comment, old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is a teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Mulan's verse, one was successful, the other not. Both secured freedom of mind, one in a god mask, the other in a devil's mask, even in defeat, a beautiful performance. So I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning and sitting together like this. It's really thrilling to see people practicing together with this kind of wholeheartedness, you know. Everybody's sitting very, very still. And let's face it, on a Saturday, we do a lot of sitting. If you can do a half day of meditation on a Saturday, you can do a sesshin, because actually this is more concentrated sitting than at sesshin. You know, this much sitting in half a day is even more rigorous than sesshin. So I compliment everybody for sitting so beautifully this morning. And it's just a great pleasure to practice with all of you. So this koan is sort of like dreamlike, you could say. We know a bit about the historical Buddha. The historical Buddha didn't sit on a throne. He didn't send people up to heaven and so on. He slept on the ground. He had he begged for his food. He was a deeply enlightened person, and we know that from historical records that people sought him out. You know, he would get up early in the morning and meditate, and then he would take his begging bowl out with all his monks and nuns and beg for food in the community. And then he would come back, and in the afternoon he would do more meditation after breakfast. He ate one meal a day. And then he would meet with people who sought his help. So, you know, anybody who wanted to speak with him could come and speak with him. And he would answer their questions and help them with their personal crises. King Bimbisara was a friend of his and would come for advice. Other people too regularly visited the Buddha, and then in the evening he would meditate again, and and continue practicing until late at night. According to the sutras, the Buddha got 1 hour of sleep every day. So he worked really hard. After his enlightenment, when he was in his early 30s, 35 people say, he spent the next 45 years of his life traveling around northeastern India and teaching the path to liberation. The sutras record his visit to many villages and many cities. And eventually the Buddha was very widely respected. And great crowds would come to see him, but he still lived this very humble life, sleeping on the ground, one robe at a time, and so on. So, you know, as Buddhism developed over time and became the Mahayana, what we call the Mahayana, you begin to see a lot of imagery from sort of like dreams or highly embellished stories, you know. And so this is a typical vision of the Buddha as like a universal monarch or, cosmic teacher, you could say. The Buddha as cosmic teacher. That was sort of later development in Buddhism. So in this koan, we sort of see the Buddha as cosmic teacher with these amazing powers. The koan's a little bit dreamlike as well, right? So it says once in the old days. In other words, not the time of the historical Buddha, but, you know, in a distant time, long ago, unspecified. Manjushri, who is the Bodhisattva of wisdom, went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found when he got there that everybody had already left and gone back to their original dwelling place. That's the language. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. And Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, asks Shakyamuni, how come she gets to sit right next to you while I cannot? Okay, so that's sort of like question number one. And then the Buddha says, okay, well, fine, you know, if you want the answer, bring her out of samadhi and ask her for yourself. And so Manjushri, in this sort of dreamlike cosmic Buddha format, also has these amazing magical powers, and he circles her 3 times, he snaps her fingers. When she doesn't come out of it, he uses his magical powers to raise her up to the highest heavens. And nothing works. She's still deep in samadhi. And then the world-honored one said, ha ha, you know, I knew you couldn't do it. And then he said, but, however, there is 100,000, even 100,000 people like you couldn't have done this. But, you know, down below, very far down below, not just in the surface, in the center of the earth, but deep in the cosmos, right? Down, down, down through, you know, many planets, many galaxies, and so on. There is a bodhisattva named Momyo, and he will arouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, the bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the world honored and gave his order. The bodhisattva went over to the girl, snapped his fingers once as she came out. So that's the story. So please sort of keep that in mind. Most of you know about my own political leanings. You know, I'm very happy that Joe Biden is vice president, president of the United States. And I think he's doing many good things, or at least many things that I approve of. So, you know, definitely happy interlude after 4 difficult years. But we've had 4 really difficult, really challenging years. And I'm happy Biden's here, but, it's been a rough ride. I think we're all a little bit stretched thin. I think that's fair to say. I have friends who have lost their businesses and friends who have lost their jobs. I talked, I think during the session, I mentioned one of my colleagues, her husband was laid off unexpectedly after 25 years. And this is somebody who has two college-age children. You know, and I can only imagine, you know, that poor, her poor husband, right? I mean, first of all, you know, I think he probably, I know him, I think he did his job very well. You know, to lose your job, it's just devastating, right? Because, you know, not only do you no longer have a check coming in every 2 weeks, but you feel like you've personally failed, right? I think it's difficult not to think that way just a little bit. And also, you know, when something like that happens, it comes right out of the blue. It's like, you know, apparently he was not prepared for this. And nobody was. There was a big layoff at the company. Probably the finances were kept more or less hush-hush. And suddenly there's this big layoff and he's let go. And there was no parachute, you know, and, you know, that kind of thing to help him transition out. You know, and I have a number of friends who are going through this right now. Another friend of mine is an independent architect and in the Southwest. And, you know, right now in certain parts of the country, not much of the kind of building he does, which is like commercial building, is going on. He specializes in like commercial buildings. And, you know, right now there's a lot of empty storefronts in the country. So he's been sort of watching his clientele walk away. And I had a chance to talk to him. And, you know, he's very funny guy, very salty. You know, he seems like he's a Southwestern person. So he has sort of a, you know, cowboy affectation, you know, which is charming. But I'm sure that, you know, my friends lie awake at night and they feel, you know, they lie awake at night, you know, and they're unable to sleep. And they feel like they don't have control over their own lives. And I think, you know, those are like dramatic examples, but I think we've all sort of felt that way over the last 4 years. I myself fully expected Hillary Clinton to become president of the United States. And I remember, going to bed thinking that Hillary was president. And then I got up the next day and it was like being in the Twilight Zone. I couldn't believe it. And I actually, in our department at Rutgers had a meeting that day. We had a department meeting. And people actually had a hard time talking. They had a hard time talking. One person who's written 3 books and he's gotten a lot of books, he said, you know, I can't even think straight this morning and I can barely speak. I'm just thunderstruck, you know. And a woman who works for me, she's very wonderful administrator and very capable person. She came into my office before I went to my department meeting and she just burst into tears, you know. So why am I dragging everybody back to all this, right? Well, you know, I think that what was most shocking about that was that it undermined our trust in ourselves and in our society, and it made us feel powerless, right? It's like that feeling that you have no control over things is, I think that more than anything else is what makes difficult times so hard to endure, right? That feeling there's just no control. You know, I expected Mrs. Clinton to be president. I went to bed thinking that nut is out of the picture now. You know, little did I know he'd be running the country. And I think we were all there to some degree. And this feeling that we don't control anything, which is always sort of, I think, an undercurrent in life, especially in modern life, became very powerful. And I think it's one of the things, or maybe the main thing, that's made the last 4 years so difficult to deal with, you know. It's feeling that I'm not controlling anything. And actually, I think the internet has contributed to this too. You know, everybody celebrated the internet for connectivity, how wonderful. You know, we're all going to be able to talk to each other. But, you know, I think one of the results of all that connectivity is that it actually reminds us of how small we are and also how powerless we are, right? So, you know, in the old days, if it's not just Facebook and things like that, but it's just the internet in general. So, you know, in the old days, if you could get a publisher to publish a book, you know, it would come out and you could walk to the bookstore and you could see the book at bookstores. You know, so if it were a commercial book, you know, you might be in New York and you might walk by a bookstore and you might see, oh my gosh, right in the window, there's my book, right? And, you know, maybe you have a book party and so on. And, you know, maybe your book gets reviewed. But, you know, the most important thing would be, you know, seeing it in the window. Maybe friends you know would read it. Maybe a critic in the New York Times would write it up, give you a favorable review. You know, and you might or might not be the next, like, Ernest Hemingway or, you know, the next great novelist who's going to make a fortune. And, you know, you get your royalty check at the end of the year, and it might be fairly small, but who cares? Because you've accomplished your mission, you know. Now, you know, when you go online, if you publish a book, it gets an Amazon, you know, an Amazon ranking number, right? So, you know, you write this book, you spend 5 years writing this book, it gets published. There aren't any bookstore windows anymore, because there aren't any more bookstores. So you go on Amazon and you look at your book and it's number 4,350,000, right? And all of a sudden you think, oh my God, you know, I'm at the bottom of this enormous pile, right? I'm at the bottom of this. It's like nobody's reading my book. You know, how could, you know, I'm number 4 million. And the next day you look and you're number 5 million, you know. You know, people I know who have written books find this really psychologically devastating. And it's because, you know, when you have a small circle of friends and you write for them, and you publish your book and it goes to reviewers, you know, it's a small circle of people who are interested in your ideas, right? But suddenly when it becomes like you're measured against the other 5 million books on sale on Amazon, you know, there's this terrible feeling like, oh, why did I even bother to write this, right? And I think the internet contributes to this feeling. I think it's one of the reasons there's so much angry discourse on the internet. You know, it's just, I think the anger is a response to like a deeply felt sense of helplessness. So I think it's really important to develop a different attitude towards helplessness. You know, I think it's extremely important. And I think in our culture, we have a mentality where we say, you know, we think of helplessness with a lot of contempt, right? It's like, oh, he's just helpless. You know, usually helplessness often elicits anger almost, you know, helpless. And when we feel helpless, we feel ashamed, you know. So I think it's really important for us to have a different view of helplessness, right? Of what it really means to be helpless. And especially we ought not to be ashamed, because if you think about it, in an interconnected world, everybody is more or less helpless, just in most ways helpless, right? You know, this is like the dark side of interbeing or interconnectivity is that, you know, we all want to be interconnected. We all, but actually, when you begin to be interconnected with 8 billion other people, you can feel helpless or powerless. Right? So I think it's important for us to develop a different understanding of what it means to be, you know, like trapped or part of 8 million people and unable to steer the ship, and that helpless feeling. I think it's very important for us to develop a different attitude towards that. You know, so, you know, I think we are not well prepared by our culture for dealing with our current situation. And you know, we have a fantasy life of people who are like superhuman, right? So my wife is a big fan of the Avengers movies, right? And, you know, if you have a threat from some other dimension, it's Loki or something else. I'm not a big fan of the movies, but, you know, you have super powerful people who can stop it, right? And the fantasy is that, you know, somebody like, some of these people have regular daily identities, like Superman. You know, Superman is a reporter, but when he needs to be powerful, he becomes, he's a reporter, Clark Kent. When he needs to become powerful, he becomes this powerful being, right? And he can fly through the air, and he can zap people with his eyes, you know, his ray, some kind of rays that come out of his eyes. He can break through steel. And that's like a fantasy we have. When we feel powerless, we want to become powerful. Right? We want to become powerful. And, you know, actually, this koan is about that, right? Manjushri is like a powerful person, right? He's, Manjushri is, you know, he's not just smart. He's not just wise. He's like the god of wisdom. He's the bodhisattva, the embodiment of wisdom. And Manjushri is going to this like a gathering of all these like superheroes, you could say, you know, Buddhist superheroes. They're all very powerful. They're like the Avengers of Buddhism, right? And when he gets there, everybody's already gone. So he's late for the party, I guess. And then he notices that even though he's not able to sit next to the Buddha, this little girl is sitting next to the Buddha, right? He basically says, well, hey, that's not fair. I'm Manjushri. I'm the Bodhisattva of wisdom. I should be able to sit next to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, okay, then use your superpowers and wake her up. And he can't wake her up. So even though it seems like talking about the Avengers might be far from this koan, you know, actually, I think this koan is touching on something really universally human, that when we feel powerless, you know, when we feel caught or trapped, you know, we have fantasies of acquiring superhuman skills. You know, I have these fantasies too, you know. I sometimes, especially when Trump was president, I thought, I wish I had the power to, you know, make him disappear or fly through the air and, beat up Mike Pence or something, you know. But, you know, there's another way of dealing with helplessness other than anger or shame or compensatory fantasies of power, right? Which are very human responses. People generally choose one of those or all of the above, right? Right now, I don't know if you were able to go outside this morning, but I do, I run the SITS online here from Rutgers University in a tutoring center. Because it has excellent, it has a cable going into the system rather than Wi-Fi, and so it's a little faster and more reliable. If something happens, I won't, like every once in a while, my neighborhood loses power in a windstorm. This is very reliable, And so I come here to do the sits. And I was driving when I got up this morning. It was, in my town, it was 17 degrees this morning. So really cold. And it went down, I think, last night to like 10. And, you know, when I opened the door and I started to go out, I really felt that cold biting at me. And the water, there's a little, like a little koi pond in our backyard that was frozen solid, right? And the bird baths, the water frozen. So I got in the car and I started driving over here. And, you know, as I was walking from the parking lot here, I noticed that there's a magnolia. And, you know, actually, in the cold, the magnolia buds start swelling up. And I looked around and I could see, like, the maple trees also. You know, they're starting to just slightly redden, the red maples. They're starting to slightly redden. You know, and actually, after we did the sutras and I went out, I looked out the window here, I could see, you know, it's like you could say the dead of winter in a certain way, right? But actually, spring is already on the way. It's like we call it winter, right? And it's 17 degrees. We call it winter. But actually, it's not just winter, right? It's cold. It's been great. Today is sunny, wonderful. But you know, nobody likes going out. But, you know, it's not really just winter. It's also becoming something else, you know. And so, you know, we have an image of what's happening. But, you know, in that reality, there's, you could say, like, there's an emerging order. There's this order we think is in play, right? Winter. And then there's this emerging order that's taking shape sort of like on the margins of our awareness. You know, but if you actually look around, you begin to see there actually are like little shoots coming out. And so if you look at the ground, when it warms up again, you begin to see, you know, we might even get crocuses coming out in a month or so. You know, so we form a mental image of how things are or how they should be. And, you know, but in reality, you know, change is constant. You know, that's the second noble truth, right? Impermanence, right? Impermanence. And change is constant. And the world is actually like a complex self-organizing system. So it's not the case that it's just winter. It's like winter, then there's spring, then there's summer, but that's not the reality. The reality is that there's this emerging condition that hasn't yet fully manifested itself, right? There's like an emerging order or an emerging coherence that we can't see. You know, and so, you know, when it's winter, you know, we can get really, really depressed. We can feel really down, especially when it's in those dark days, right? You know, the dark days of December before the sun begins to, the days begin to get longer again. You know, it's getting dark at like 4:15. It's icy cold, you know, but actually that's our mental image. So the point I'm trying to make is that we tend to think in these simplistic ways. And reality is never like that, you know. And I think we discover this on the cushion. You know, if you think about something like Zazen, you know, Zazen is actually like, one way to think about Zazen anyway, is that it's actually like training in being helpless. Yeah, actually. In being trapped. You know, or immobilized and unable to change anything. So, you know, we learn to sit down on the cushion and straighten the back and breathe from the dantian, the hara. And you know, we understand this as like mental transformation and so on. And it is in a certain way. But, you know, in the most rudimentary, most rudimentary way, what we're learning to do is to be helpless, like completely helpless. So you sit down on a cushion and you watch your breath and you don't move a muscle. And you start, you watch your breath, and eventually, you know, actually, without any conscious intention on your part, your consciousness begins to shift, right? It's like without any, you know, most people who begin meditation don't know what's going to happen next. So the teacher says, sit down on the cushion, straighten your back, breathe from the dantian, squeeze the breath out, and the breath goes out, 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 and you say, okay, good luck, right? So basically, you know, the person engaged in this practice doesn't know what's coming next. And what's coming next is not what that person probably expected. You know, you watch the breath, you watch the breath, and you begin to go into an altered state of consciousness, right? It's like you begin to enter what we call samadhi. And that wasn't expected, actually. For most people, it's a complete surprise. And sometimes it's a really amazing experience. You know, every once in a while, a beginner will, when we used to meet in face-to-face, a beginner would come into the Zendo and I'd tell her what to do. And I can remember over the years, there have been these people who had like ecstatic samadhi experiences. They just said, that was, you know, one person just said, what was that? You know, that was so wonderful. Not everybody has experiences like that. But, you know, the thing is, you sit down on the cushion, you immobilize yourself, and actually you just focus on something so small, you know, the breath, and you follow this breath out and this breath out. You know, from a certain standpoint, this is like becoming almost, you know, you're almost like a vegetable, right? You're just absolutely motionless, and you're barely, the only thing you're doing is breathing, basically. So it's the opposite of being active, actively engaged. It's like, and you're also like withdrawing into yourself, you could say, and you're just focused on this breath, right? And then something begins to happen, something begins to change, right? Begins to change. Your consciousness shifts and you begin to feel connected. You know, actually one of the ways that, one of the things that makes samadhi so delightful is this experience of like, connectedness. You go deep in yourself, you become helpless, you know, actually like totally immobilized, and you basically don't know what you're doing or where you're going. And, you know, all of a sudden you enter this altered state of consciousness, and you know, in Zen, this is described very poetically as dying on the cushion or dropping the body. And actually, it feels sometimes like that's what you're doing, like you're dying on the cushion or dropping the body. And then there's like this shift of consciousness, and you can begin to feel this very powerful sense of well-being and connectedness and even energy. You know, this is like a different response to helplessness, different response to not having control, right? It's like, when you lose control, what should you do? Lose even more control. When you lose control, my advice is give up all control. See, that's what Zen is actually saying to you. You know, to practice for those moments in life when you are going to lose some control, try losing all control, right? And that's, Zen is sort of like radical medicine, right? Radical treatment. So, you know, you sit down on the cushion, you immobilize yourself, the thoughts begin to stop, and you're in this place which is really, you're really out of control. And, you know, it's like something takes over, something happens, you know, and you begin to feel your consciousness shift, and you begin to have this sense of connectedness or well-being. You don't make it happen, it just happens. Right? And, you know, actually, it happens because it's in the nature of consciousness itself, right? So, you know, consciousness itself isn't what we think, right? It's constantly changing too, actually. And it has these qualities that we don't necessarily appreciate when we're in our normal task-centered way of thinking about things. But, you know, when we become helpless on the cushion, you know, we begin to experience consciousness more directly as like this dynamic process, you could say, right? You begin to experience consciousness as this dynamic process. And consciousness is, so there's always in consciousness, like something that's falling apart. Like it's like the order of things is falling apart. And at the same time, there's like this emergent order that's happening. And you know, in Zen, when we do Zen practice, we begin to be much more aware of this dynamic process, right? So actually, you know, the Zen practice could be understood as training for those moments when we feel powerless or helpless. And the advice the practice is giving us is, you know, when you're in that state, intensify that sense of helplessness or immobility or lack of control, right? And when you do that, what happens next is that you begin to feel this very powerful sense of connectedness to things or well-being, right? And I would say that the sense of being out of control or helpless is true from a certain standpoint or in a certain state of mind, right? But, you know, Buddhism says that standpoint or that state of mind is a small mind perspective, right? It's our habitual mental, it's a place we go to habitually. It's our sort of reality. But it, from the Buddhist standpoint, it's a partial view. It's an imperfect understanding of the situation. You know, in every situation, there's this unfolding, emerging order, right? And when we go into deep samadhi, we begin to experience that happening in our own consciousness. So we go from this feeling of being totally immobilized to feeling energized and connected. And Buddhism would say that feeling of being energized and connected isn't an illusion. It's like a bigger picture. You know, so it's definitely the case that I couldn't control who got elected in 2016. I tried to control it, but I couldn't. And like many people, you know, the day after the election, I felt very powerless. And that's definitely a kind of reality. But you know, one of the things I did not long after the election was to get right back on the cushion, you know, and I did a lot of zazen, and you know, I would enter that state of deep samadhi where I felt connected. I felt that I was part of something that was emerging, that was taking form. And I would say Zen doesn't believe that that's, Buddhism doesn't think that's an illusion. Buddhism thinks that's a superior understanding of the situation. You know, so when we feel helpless, we don't see our options because we keep thinking in the same old ways, right? We keep thinking in the same old ways. And because we keep thinking in the same old ways, we can't respond to the changing situation. You know, what we need to do is something that we haven't done before. And because the situation is changing, we haven't like invented the response we need. And we'll never invent the response we need if we draw on what we already know, which was appropriate for yesterday, but not for tomorrow. So this ability to drop down into helplessness, to like go in, right? And then you empty yourself out and you begin to feel connected to something, you know, begin to feel connected to this emerging order. Right? This is like the beginning of a new relationship with the world around you. You know, and people go through this in Zen practice quite routinely. You know, if, you know, very often, you know, koans address obstacles that we carry around with us that we've never been able to work through. And you know, when you encounter an immovable obstacle, you are immobilized. And when you're working with some koans, you feel totally helpless, totally unable to respond to the situation. You're stymied, you're blocked, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, in Zen tradition, you know, we say that when Bodhidharma went to China, you know, he was invited to speak to Emperor Wu of Liang. And Emperor Wu had invested money in all these monasteries and convents and libraries, and this was Bodhidharma's big chance to bring Zen to China. And when they had this interview, it was a disaster. You know, based very famous moment in Zen history. You know, the great Zen teacher Bodhidharma comes from India. He meets the emperor of this part of China. They're supposed to hit it off. He's supposed to write Bodhidharma a big check, and that never happens. They try to talk, and they talk at cross purposes, and Bodhidharma leaves. And the story says that Bodhidharma went up into the mountains near what is now Shaolin Temple, and he sat in a cave for 9 years, waiting for students to show up. You know, and this is how he responded to failing, to being trapped, to not knowing what to do, right? To being powerless. You know, he could have, you know, tried to organize a speaking tour. He could have written the best-selling book and gone on television and radio programs. Maybe he would get on Gary Null's radio program or something like that, and WBAI, and maybe All Things Considered would interview him. But he didn't do that, right? He went up and sat in a cave for 9 years. And you could say, well, what a counterproductive strategy, right? But he was doing what I'm talking about, right? He sat down and he did what's called Pequan. He confronted his obstacle. Right, the blank wall of our obstacle, whatever it is, Trump, whatever, right? And we can't go forward doing what we did, but we don't know how to go forward. We don't know what we need to do now, right? So the thinking we bring to the problem isn't the solution thinking. The solution thinking has to be something new. But how do we find something new when all we have is old ideas, right? So Bodhidharma sits down on his cushion and faces the wall and goes deep into himself. He empties out and he begins to feel that he's part of an emerging order. He gets to connect with the emergent order, the emerging reality, right? And you know, after 9 years, the students start showing up. This is like the Zen approach to, you know, helplessness is a kind of it's perspectively, it's real, but it's also a kind of optical illusion, right? You know, getting out of that feeling of being blocked or helpless requires a different kind of consciousness, you know, and if you can get into deep samadhi and you begin to have that sense of connection to the world around you, you know, suddenly everywhere you turn, there are opportunities to act. You know, everywhere you turn, there's opportunities to act. But, you know, those opportunities to act come from a strange place in us, right? They don't come from the discriminating mind, they come from this deeper intelligence. So, you know, in this koan, that deeper intelligence is represented in this little story by Momyo. So Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He has all the wisdom, all the knowledge in the world, but he doesn't know how to solve this problem. He doesn't know how to bring the problem, in this case, is bringing this girl out of samadhi, right? So you could say she's stuck, she's blocked, and she's stuck, and she's unable to get out of her being blocked and begin to re-engage with things around her. And even his wisdom won't wake her up. And the koan says that, however, you know, the Buddha says, down, 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 down in the earth, or down there somewhere, in the depths of your big mind, in the depths of your unconscious, there's a more dynamic intelligence, you could say, more dynamic intelligence. And Momyo is a beginner. He has what is called in Zen beginner's mind. Beginner's mind. Choshi. Momyo is just a beginner. And the beginner can do what the wise person can't, because the beginner has like fresh perspective. And as soon as he springs up out of the earth, he snaps his fingers and she wakes up. Because, basically what we need now is something new. The way out of our feeling of helplessness, we can't access with the small mind, which relies on what it already knows. We have to draw on this deeper intelligence. And, the truth is, I think people who are creative often know about this. I remember, I don't know if you like Aaron Copland, any Aaron Copland fans out there, but I'm a big Aaron Copland fan, and I love Fanfare for the Common Man, and I love Appalachian Spring. And, I remember reading an interview with the composer Aaron Copland, and they tried to get him to talk about writing his music, and he said, I don't write my music. He said, I don't know how it happens, right? He said, it just happens, And many people talk about this as like a key to their creative process, this period of like not knowing. I remember reading this interview with this very famous sculptor. His name is Giacometti. Giacometti is very widely respected 20th century sculptor. And his work is really powerful and beautiful. And it was an article, this guy spent like a week with Giacometti. And, they would go into Giacometti's studio, and Giacometti would, he had his clay models wrapped in wet burlap, basically, to keep them pliable. And he'd take the burlap off, and he'd sit there, and he'd sit all day and just sit and look at these things and smoke. And then he'd shake his head and put the wraps back on and walk away. And this would go on day after day. And the guy who was doing the story said, I would go in every day. Giacometti would sit there and look for like an hour or 2 hours. And he'd say, oh, let's go get some wine, or whatever. But he said one day he just walked in, took off his tools, and just started working. And he said he worked for like 14 hours or something. This is a process of accessing the momyo mind inside of us, the beginner's mind, right? Beginner's mind isn't normally accessible without a lot of sitting. We have to be totally blocked to find our beginner's mind. And so, whenever we are blocked, there's always there can be panic, shame, projections of failure and so on. But, if you go through this process long enough, you realize, anybody who's done koan training, I can remember so many sessions where I'm sitting in the cold and the dark. And, it's just cold and dark outside, and it's cold and dark inside, right? And, I've been doing this for 40 some years, but I've had many sessions where like on Wednesday night I'm exhausted and I can't answer my koan, and it's cold and it's dark, and I'm sitting there thinking, what the hell, what am I doing here, and sometimes I've gone to bed thoroughly defeated, and then you get up and you sit back on the cushion, and it's like just this little, it's like an ember, like a little ember lights up, right? And it turns into this fire. And you think, where did that come from? Where did that come from? It came from deep in the earth, you could say, deep in your mind. There's this energy we learn how to access. When you've been totally whipped, you've been totally defeated, you're totally blocked, you sit down on the cushion, and it's like all of a sudden there's like a little light that goes on. You know, it's like, oh my, and now I know. Now I know what to do. Now I know how to answer my koan. And this is not just about Zen, it's about everything in life. You know, everything in life. So one way to respond to helplessness is with self-loathing and anger. But another way is to see it, even though this sounds a little crazy, is that this is an opportunity. Helplessness just means we're going in the wrong direction. The universe is going right and we want to go left. And, you know, when the universe is going right and we're trying to go left, we feel trapped. We feel helpless. Maybe we need to go right, you know, but maybe we don't understand how to go right. So you sit down on the cushion and you enter a machine and suddenly, you know, you get to it's cold and dark inside and it's cold and dark outside, but suddenly it's like a little light comes on and that just turns into like the sun coming up in your head. And then you know what you need to do, right? You know, now you know what you need to do. Once in the old days, in the time of the world-honored one, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and he found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. So Manjushri's already late. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni, why can this girl get near the throne while I cannot? I, the great Manjushri. Shakyamuni Buddha said, bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself. Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers, took her to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. So this is all stuff Manjushri has been doing for years, right? It's not going to help now. The universe is going right and Manjushri is going left. The world-honored one said, even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, in other words, deep in your big mind, there is a Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth, right? Just from nowhere, and made a bow to the world-honored one who gave him his imperial order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mumon's comment, old Shakyamuni put on a petty drama and failed to enlighten the masses. In other words, when Mumon is being critical, he's being complimentary. He means the Buddha was a great teacher. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he rouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the biggest, busiest activity of consciousness. If you can access that place in your life, you know, nothing is going to stop you. Okay, Mumon's verse. One was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind, one in a god mask, the other in a devil mask, even in defeat, a beautiful performance. Right?